And so with hydro, it's really interesting. Like you have, it's basically direct to chip cooling. And this has been, this is something that's existed in just data centers forever. But with mining, we're seeing like with this direct to chip cooling, specifically in a like liquid form, you kind of have like a mix of water and like a glycol mix. It's basically like shooting, cold water basically on these chips and cycling them in real time. And so you're getting like very precise cooling at the chip level. And so like that's really important because the quality of the chip basically degrades exponential with the temperature.
Hash rate up. Hardware sales, advisory, hosting, and site brokerage. Find new and used ASIC deals through the website and the Telegram channel below. Make smarter decisions with Hashrate Up. Welcome back, everybody, to Hashrate Up. It's a very, very interesting time. Very, very interesting time. Sorry, it's late for me. There's going to be a lot of these in Bitcoin mining right now. And I have my good friend and supporter of the show and overall partner, Tom, with me. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hey, Jesse, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm still smiling. We just sat here for quite a bit talking about the market and stuff and just decided to riff it, basically, which is often no pressure. Some of the best shows just end up coming from a point like that. For the first time ever, I believe, hash price sits below $30. So we are now well into the pain zone. Bitcoin feel price, let's just give a brief overview. I don't feel it anymore. Bitcoin price is at $64,000. Hash price sits at 29. Hash rate still at 900. We're still looking at our difficulty adjustment of minus 13%, which will bump that back up again. But I'm sure as Bitcoin is falling, we're going to see even lower hash price in the meantime. We're at 11 minutes and 30 seconds average block time. Let's quickly look at the time chain calendar. At block height 935163 is when we were recording this. And if my eyes don't deceive me,
look at hash rate. Says hash rate below 900 exahash.
Yeah. And then we are also 266 blocks too slow. We're in the middle of, and I said this in a video before, a focus episode that I did where I just, covered the hash price and the difficulty development right now. I think we're looking at very unprecedented times. We've had crazy times like this when the China mining ban happened and when Bitcoin dropped from $32, the enormous heights of $32 all the way down to two, I believe. And I think we're seeing something like that. We're on our way. When this 13% hits, I think we will be at around 25% overall over the last 12 weeks. And a lot of people are hurting right now, Tom. What are your thoughts at the moment looking at this?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts. So like one is obviously the steepness of the Bitcoin price kind of drop. Like we've been through things like this in the past. And I think there were a lot of discussions and like people thinking kind of previously like, oh, the four-year cycle theory is dead. We have, we're in this super cycle and the ups won't be as high, but the lows won't, the drops won't be as high. I think we're like learning in real time that like, hey, this is still, at least the price of Bitcoin is still a volatile thing. But I don't think the thesis, at least from my perspective, has really changed, right? Like nothing has changed in like the code of this thing. Nothing has changed in like how the economics of mining work. Like it's the same thing. We're just seeing, volatility in the price. And there's probably a lot of reasons as to like why that is, but that's kind of like my first take. The other thing is like, yeah, like people are feeling a lot of pain right now. I think if you are in a position going into this where maybe you had higher expectations and maybe you were making decisions around like, leverage and different things, it can, be a bit of a scary time. I think for us, like we live in the world of mining and hash price and how these systems work. And so I think, it still is true that like, as long as you're not, overpaying for the ASICs and in your initial kind of deployment, as long as you have good operating partners and you're kind of on the right side of the efficiency curve, we could say, like leaning towards, higher efficiency machines relative to the the average on the network. It's really just a game about staying online, right? We kind of see as hash price corrects when difficulty goes up, we'll see hash price correcting until, you know, machines don't turn off anymore, basically. And we don't know when that will be, but like, that's just how the economics kind of play out here. And so I think it's interesting to be talking about this right now, because obviously there's a lot of, like, you know, people are worried, there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of, also a lot of things going on just like in the world in general. Like we were talking about how gold as an asset class, like is completely ripping, how the price of the dollar relative to, you know, other currencies is trading. So for us, like, there's a lot of noise. We kind of just focus on the bare bones of mining economics. And I think, like, if you have high efficiency machines that you paid a good price for and you're running in good conditions, like, you'll be able to withstand a lot of this. And then over time, like, you're just stacking more Bitcoin if the price, you know, relatively drops, right? You're going to be stacking more in terms of, like, staying online. So
yeah, it's a time where and I just want to pull this up, you know, I've shown this before, like the way the Bitcoin hash price increases in Bitcoin terms as the difficulty keeps decreasing. I think it's what you said is very right. Like, everybody just kind of has to decide what do they want. And it's a very weird thing to think about. What do you want your economic basis to be? You know, it's a very fundamental question, because I was telling you that the South African rand just increased in value versus the dollar. And you were saying, you know, that's what we want as Americans. My rent just went from like, went up by $250, you know, which is roughly, I want to say 5%, 7.5% over the last 6 weeks, just because of dollar, dollar and rand exchange rate. And at
is
the same time,
denominated Bitcoin drops. In US dollars then? Is that what you're saying?
No, but I convert it because that's often what I earn in.
I see.
Right? I earn from overseas. So, so yeah, it's just a very weird time where there is no clear anchor, you know? Mm-hmm. And you feel this like on a global stage, but then also, you know, it's starting to affect our personal lives, especially as we are so exposed to Bitcoin volatility itself. But that's kind of where this whole Bitcoin thing helps me, right? Because that's essentially my long-term vision is, you know, I've made the choice long ago to value everything in sats, right? And we were talking right about customers of yours that are now, you know, maybe slightly miffed or have negative sentiment because they bought machines maybe 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, and now the machines are literally half the price or, you know, somewhere in between. And I was just saying, look, if you price the machines in Bitcoin terms, they're still the same price. They haven't changed right in price, right? Because the machine.
Right. I think that's important, right? Like to understand that the way ASIC pricing works and the way a lot of these economics, it's a lot of it is denominated in Bitcoin. So if you kind of look at, you know, the relative Bitcoin that you spent versus now and the value of the machines, yes, in dollars, it may be different, but the value of Bitcoin in dollars is different as well. So if you're denominating in Bitcoin, you're actually like, you know, your assets in those machines is actually like pretty much still the same.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's because everything that I do, you know, when you make a large investment, when you buy a car, you know, I bought a car at this price range, I think over a year ago, and afterwards the price just jumped up to near 100 or whatever, and I was like, damn, what a bad decision, right? Now I'm like, hey, the car is the same price again, you know, so it's like. It's just a matter of perspective. And yes, sure, like we can buy less for the money that we have. And what I feel for most is those people who get told, hey, save your money in sats, save your money in sats, especially those. And this is a bit off topic, but here in South Africa, you know, when we talk about using Bitcoin, and we just finished the Adopting Bitcoin conference last weekend, and a lot of newcomers, you know, that are there, that for them maybe $500 is a lot of money, right? And if they have it all in sats, their halvings just got halved as well, and they might not be able to afford that. And that's often, you know, the volatility is what keeps Bitcoin from being this great asset that we think it will be at some point. But then again, you find volatility everywhere, right? Gold market is what, 34 trillion. And it just dropped by 20% over the course of 2 weeks. Like it's nuts.
It dropped more than the market cap of Bitcoin. And I think like when we think about mining, like we talk about this all the time, it's like the game is, how do I stay online and keep my machines making, you know, generating Bitcoin in an economically viable way for as long as possible, so I'm able to get the most out of those machines. And I think like having options to be able to continue running the machines in, you know, different economic times with deals like profit share deals and, you know, redeploying machines instead of just sitting on them and scrapping them. Like, I think those options are emerging as the like reality of the economics kind of play out. And I think there's a world where like if you have a machine, you can actually keep the machine running as long as its useful life and still be benefiting from that. I think it's going to take a while to get there, but like those are the types of things that like we always talk about and we're always working on. It's like, okay, given an efficiency of a machine, does this contract structure even make sense? At what point do we need to consider, you know, turning this into a profit share structure or redeploying it somewhere else? Because, you know, customers still want to, you know, hold the exposure to the productive compute asset that is the ASIC. That's a really interesting thing. And I think a lot of people just need to understand and have the right expectations when kind of engaging with the mining market. Like what we're seeing is not anything new. It's just, you know, maybe it's new to some people, but.
This episode is sponsored by Hashbranch, the easiest way to mine Bitcoin in the US. Sourcing hardware and rack space usually is a mess. Bad deal structures, misaligned incentives, and no visibility after deployment. I have placed tens of thousands of ASICs in partnership with Hashbranch. What I like most is that they cut through the noise. Fair pricing, aligned terms, and access to hosting that actually works. Use code HASHRATEUP100, visit hashbranch.com today to get $100 off of each miner that you order.
Yeah, no, again, what you say is right. You know, the two of us always look for opportunities to make people money while being incentivized, obviously, to have successful customers, right? I think it's very important. We don't charge 30-40% margins on these machines. We don't charge overcharge on the hosting rate, I think. And so, you know, I just did a focus episode that will be released when we release this interview, or this chat, I should say, where, you know, you do hydro hosting for two reasons, maybe just to recap that quickly, right? This is what I'm very, very bullish on, is we do hydro hosting for two reasons: a long financial lifespan that we have access to, and then a long physical lifespan, right? There's no moving parts. The machine doesn't really get in touch with the environment as much. There's no air moving through it. You just have, you know, water cooling the machines. They run at 30, 40 degrees Celsius instead of 60, 70, 80, depending on ambient temperature. And then, you know, if we sort of solve for the physical lifespan, the way we handle the financial lifespan for situations like this are profit splits, you know, where... Mm-hmm. We just make a portion of the hosting rate variable, which means that you break even now when hash price is at $30, you're mining at 6 cents, right? But if hash price is at $100, you're mining at 14 cents, right? Sure, right. That's giving up a lot of upside, right? But the downside protection, once the machine is near or at ROI, the downside protection is invaluable, because this market is so volatile still, right? And so then the modeling is less relevant. If you can guarantee that the machine stays online longer, the modeling and the scenarios have less of a weight, right? Because the problem comes when you have no other option than to turn off, not to lose money, right? And at that point, you're stuck and you're sitting on less Bitcoin that you mined than you could have bought 2.5 years ago. But there's a question here, Tom, also, right? Just to critically critique our thinking as well, right? If I was devil's advocate now, I would say, okay, what guarantees that the the hosting provider that actually manages the machines and owns the power contracts and stuff, how do we make sure that we select hosts that don't turn around and want to do AI once the contract period is finished? Because then the machine is out of there.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think there's a lot of thoughts there, because we have, like, on one hand, we have this like massive explosion in just AI as a technology, right? Mainly through like generative AI. And then we're seeing like agents and all these things spin up. So like there's a massive kind of exponential growth in that as like a technology. And then from that is kind of as an asset class in general. Like I think, you know, the way we look at mining is like one type of compute. It just happens to be like the most, you know, liquid form of compute that you can basically sell perpetually on the market, because the buyer of that compute is the Bitcoin mining network, right? So with mining, it's like, hey, the economics might be different, but at least you don't have to solve for who's going to buy my compute. But at the same time, we have these massive tailwinds that are saying, you know, the investment, the global spend in CapEx for AI infrastructure, including, call it the GPUs, the power infrastructure, everything it takes to run AI compute, specifically like large training loads, inference, and other things, is in like the trillions. Like that's what people are publicly saying. We're talking like $5 to $10 trillion by the next, you know, at the end of the decade. Like that's what people are putting. So when you see like this massive market, there are like, you know, there are, you think about it, you're like, hey, you know, if I'm building a data center, or I'm, you know, if I have access to a lot of power, should I look into AI compute? And I think the answer is like, yeah, you should look into it. There are like a lot of times where the economics make a lot of sense. It's not easy though. Like it's not as simple as like, you know, I get some GPUs and then there's a Bitcoin equivalent that can just monetize them perfectly. The problem that's still unsolved, at least to my knowledge, is like clear liquidity for your compute that you're generating on the AI side. So like even the groups that are considering this sort of like transition, which I think we'll see a lot of, don't get me wrong, that it's a very difficult problem. So I think for that reason, it's going to take a long time to solve. Maybe, you know, people will probably solve it in different ways, but I think like that is something we need to have a conversation around, which is like, hey, if a current, you know, host has a bunch of infrastructure and they decide to transition everything to kind of AI and compute, that is something that could happen. And, you know, for our customers specifically, like on one hand, we have, you know, very strong like relationships and contracts with our operators. So like, even if that were to occur, it would occur like after our, you know, client contracts are over and we'd have a redeployment and a relocation kind of strategy already built in. We're constantly forward planning. But I think realistically, like it's not going to happen in like overnight, all capacity is now AI. It's probably a transition. And most likely, I think the best solution is to have a mix of compute resources, you know, at any one location. Because like, right, you know, for example, like right now, like if you converted everything to AI, it might be hyper profitable today. It could also be not super profitable in 6 to 12 months, depending on how the economics play out. So like you kind of want to hedge your revenue streams. And I think that's going to play out at the operator level as well.
Yeah. So I think, you know, you bring actually a lot of value to operators, because now, you know, besides just being able to self mine and being exposed to Bitcoin volatility or doing the AI where you have to look for your customer and all of that, all of the things that you just said, you also have an aggregator like yourselves, and you just make a margin on the power. And then also I was thinking while you were speaking, how does uptime play into this? And does Bitcoin mining maybe move to those points in the grid where uptime is 85%, 80%?
Yeah, no, for sure.
I wouldn't mind my miner being online 85% of the year if the power price reflected that opportunity.
Exactly. So like, because you can, so like with mining, because you kind of control for like who is the customer, right? You can always mine Bitcoin. You just need internet and power and a compute resource, an ASIC. Because of that, you kind of, the only trade-offs you really can make are uptime and base, call it power or hosting costs. Those are really the two variables you have. But the reality is that like when you know, most new machines, we talked about this on the last podcast, like we think of like the brand new machines, generally speaking, you want to start them at a high uptime environment because you want to, you know, monetize those as long as possible. But the reality is like economically, it might make sense to actually run efficient units at a lower uptime because your base costs can be lower. So really what you're trying to optimize for is like the time online that is profitable. And like that can be, you know, maybe you're only running 83% of the time, but your base is much lower. So you're actually able to stay online. And so those are the things that happen with AI and kind of the whole, you know, the compute markets around, call it like GPU compute. We kind of coined this term industrial compute, like mining is one type, but you have kind of this other type that's emerging with GPUs. Like uptime is like very interesting because in order to even be able to monetize them well, you have to hit a strict requirement for like even selling that compute. Meaning like you need to basically be a tier three data center. A tier three data center is like, you know, I don't know all the technical kind of specifications, but it's like very high uptime, very high redundancy. We're talking like 99.999% uptime. A lot of times you need, I think on some of the compute marketplaces, you literally need access to two separate grid tied substations for redundancy. And you need like, I think fiber as well as like another backup. You know, so like there's a lot of infrastructure diesel that's even required. And so like, yes, I think mining, like, but there's energy everywhere. So I think with, you know, mining will basically be able to be spun up and economical in places that don't yet have that infrastructure. Over time, it will make sense to maybe bring that infrastructure in and then start to diversify revenue streams. But like this stuff moves at the speed of the physical world, which means like to build a data center and actually do this, we're talking, you know, months, if not years. Like a lot of the capacity and a lot of the big infrastructure that's getting, that's coming online this year was all contracted like 3 years ago. So like, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, no, look, I just before we started recording, we read the news, courtesy of the friends at the Miner Mag, that there were 250 gigawatts of power requests in the ERCOT queue being reshuffled. So it's just such an interesting time in energy and AI and Bitcoin mining. And I just have a feeling that getting a machine today, which costs the same amount of Bitcoin as it did 4 weeks ago, might just be a really, really good decision in 5 years from now. Especially if it's still running then, and you can guarantee that, you know, and you have access because, you know, the hosts that we deal with, they don't qualify for AI if their uptime is 90%. 95%. They don't have that option, right? They have all that capital investment. And if the grid operator only offers them 90% uptime, which they have control over in the contracts that they sign, then AI isn't an option.
Right. At least not today. And not with a massive, you know, retrofit and CapEx spend. And even like just the, it's something that can happen and probably will in some places. I don't think it's going to happen across the board. Like everywhere that was mining is now AI. I think that's what people kind of say. And that's the like simple answer, but I think it's going to be more complicated than that. The other thing I'll throw out there, and this is like just kind of a, maybe an AI black swan or like something to kind of like just get thinking is we just like recently saw, I don't know if you saw the news, but like there's SpaceX is basically going to be merging with XAI. So like kind of the Elon's like AI company and like SpaceX, which basically owns like 80% of the market of, you know, sending payload to orbit, and they have, you know, Starlink and whatnot. And you can read like how they're talking about this. They think that a lot of compute is going to move to space. Now, whether that happens or not, and that completely changes the economics. So like, there's a lot of things that could happen, and like the build out for AI, you know, we'll say on the ground in, you know, those economics could completely change if it's actually possible to do this at scale for, you know, cheap, outside of like, well, I guess the planet, which is a weird thing to say. So I don't know, what are we going to see Bitcoin mining in space? Yeah, exactly.
Solar mining.
You get far enough out.
I had the guy on,
the Earth is for mining, space is for AI.
Yeah. Oh, you know, you get exactly. You have solar uptime 100%. I had this guy on talking about mining in space. No, for sure. But it's definitely, very interesting time right now. I would like to ask you, Tom, how do you, or just explain to people briefly you know, let's say they have a fleet of machines with other hosters somewhere, and they're not profitable, be it K-Pros, I don't know, whatever it is. How do people do this? Like, what is their first move after they contact you? What do you do with these machines? And maybe briefly explain how the profit split mechanism works.
Yeah, for sure. So like a big part of our business, like from the get-go, was all around this idea of redeployment. And it's basically like, hey, I have this hardware already. I bought it, you know, whatever price. Here's the efficiency of the hardware. It's now out of contract at another facility, or it is sitting on a pallet somewhere. It's not being well monetized. What can you do, right? And so we've been working on this problem for years now. And basically, like, the way it works for us is, like, a customer will come to us and say, hey, like, I have X amount of units of this make and, you know, makeup and efficiency. We basically intake all of their hardware in terms of like, okay, how many units do you have? What types of units? What are the efficiencies? Where are they? And what's the situation? When do you think you can actually move them? Once we have all that, we basically say, okay, like, what's the quality of the machines? Because, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but like a lot of machines, like you know, when you originally bought them, they've been running somewhere. You don't know how well they've been taken care of. They might've been running, but like maybe the filtration wasn't great and you have debris everywhere. And like, so we try to get an understanding for the quality. This comes like ideally through hash reports. So like, what's the operating status of the machines, at least as close as you can give us. So like, if they're running right now, great. If they were running, do you have any data on that? The second piece is like, okay, what's the quality of the machine? So this is kind of subjective, but basically like, are they dusty? Are they, you know, do they have corrosion? Like, what does that look like? Once we have all that data, like it's pretty straightforward. On the back end, what we've done is we've contracted out and we have rack space that like basically matches the profile of these units. And so what happens is, like, we kind of talked about this earlier, you might have contracts that have low base rate, low uptime. You wouldn't put a new unit there, but you might put a K-Pro or an XP. That's like the first piece. So we have contracts in place that allow us to kind of redeploy older units. The second piece is the profit share component. So in these contracts, you kind of have the ability to, hey, I just want a low rate, low uptime. I'm cool with that. Or I actually want an even lower rate and then have a split of the kind of the rewards less the costs with the operating party. That's like easy to describe. It's actually hard to pull off because there's a lot of like mechanisms around billing and how are you calculating this and how are you settling and all this stuff. Our, you know, software really orchestrates that. And then we have the contracts on the back end that basically is the rack space that can take your machine. So once we've kind of like, okay, we know what types of machines they are, we get an understanding, we have the rack space ready. The next step is like, if the units are not in good quality, and I'll say, like, as an example, hey, they've been sitting on pallets. I don't even have pictures. You know, some of them are broken. We don't know. We generally have a checkpoint before the redeployment. Sometimes this is at the site. So like sometimes a site is capable of doing the checkpoint. Sometimes we have to send them to a repair stopover to like get checked, basically. What that means is like they will take it in, diagnose them, be like, okay, you know, X amount of machines are actually good to go. The others need maybe a new power supply, new hash board, whatever. And they do a cleaning, basically to get them ready for the redeployment. Because a lot of operators that we work with, like, the last thing they want is units to show up that just don't work or are junk, because they want to monetize.
Just to add this, Tom.
Yeah.
It's also an objective checkpoint, right? These repair centers, they're being paid
exactly
to check the machines, and they're an objective neutral party. So that exactly. There's also no discourse after the fact where Hashbrench says, no, the units are shite, basically, and the customer says, no, they were all working when I sent them off. What happened? Right. So no, you right. have somebody in the middle that says, hey, you know, pay me, I don't know, $20 a machine, and I will give you a report on it and give you a spreadsheet that tells you exactly what the state of these machines is at the moment. BitX, solomining.de, got it. Premium, made in Germany. You want to go fancy? Go for NerdX or NerdQX++ for a lot of power. Worldwide shipping. Check out solomining.de today.
Exactly. And like, ideally you get that before they leave the original facility. You kind of, they've taken good care of it. They have the data. It's pretty simple. But we have a lot of cases where, like I said, units are just in storage containers. We don't even know how they've been treated. So that checkpoint is really important to, like, one, just like give you a reality check, because like, even if you get these units plugged in without a checkpoint, if only, you know, 70% of them even hash, you have no idea what's going on. So that's like an important step. And yeah, like it's a, you know, it's a verified like repair center or someone that we've worked with who's like done this with us. They don't really have skin in the game to like, you know, on either side. They're just like, hey, like this is the reality. You know, we get diagnostic reports and photos and all that stuff, really trying to just like streamline the process. So once you've kind of given us the intake data, we've kind of made a decision, like, should it get checked at a third party, or does the site have a process? Then we go through the redeployment, and like, even that is kind of complex because the way, you know, these are physical servers moving. So like, as an example, I always talk about each one of the, each one of these ASICs is about 35 pounds, like a standard like air cool unit, call it like an S19K Pro or XP. It's like 35 pounds, right? And you can only fit maybe, you know, 20 to 30 of them on a pallet. And so we're talking about like, that's, you know, right there, we're talking about, you know, thousands of pounds, you know, maybe like 1,000 to 1,500 pounds of servers, depending. A lot of these deployments, like it might be 5 to 10 pallets. And so we're talking like on the order of, you know, tens of thousands of pounds of servers that need to like go through this process, and they need to physically move across, you know, we only operate in the US, so they're moving across, across the country sometimes. Just takes time. So like this, the logistics of getting the deployment going, ideally you can just snap your fingers and they're online in another spot. But the reality is like, they're going to come in batches. Those batches are going to have serial numbers associated. The site needs to understand, you know, what's going on with those. It takes time to ramp those up. But yeah, once they're going and you're kind of in this better structure, then like we've seen like machines just stay online longer because the economics make sense.
Yeah. No, exactly. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It's a cool Tom, problem.
Before we, yeah, it's absolutely. And there's, it seems endless demand for it. I've seen somebody today advertise M30 units stacked 80 on a pallet. I'm like, no, thank you.
Yeah, that's gonna tip over in transit, and then people are gonna be pointing at each other.
And that bottom row is probably feeling a lot of pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, last time we talked a bunch about type 1 and type 2 facilities also. Mm-hmm. And going back to the hydro idea, and again, please, if you haven't, look at my little focus episode on the hydro hosting, where I go into a lot more detail on this, right? Right. The idea is to have a machine deployed and then be able, without touching it and without moving it, to just change the business model to keep it more profitable. And change it to a type 2 facility without having to physically move the machine. What else, Tom? Do we have anything else, or do we do
rapid fire? Let me talk a little bit about hydro, because I think it's really, really interesting. Like,
yeah,
at the end of the day, as the ASICs themselves, so everyone talks about an ASIC. I bought an ASIC, all this stuff. What you're buying is, or like what you have is like an ASIC server, really. And like, it's basically just a chassis with a bunch of hashboards, and each hashboard has, you know, dozens of these individual ASIC chips. And so like the reality is like with these chips, as the efficiency increases over time and we have OEMs releasing new variants, like at some point you're starting to hit like physical reality in terms of like how you can actually dissipate the heat that comes off of these chips. And so with hydro, it's really interesting. Like you have, it's basically direct to chip cooling. And this has been, you know, this is something that's existed in just data centers forever. But with mining, we're seeing like with this direct to chip cooling, specifically in a like liquid form, you kind of have like a mix of water and like a glycol mix. It's basically like shooting, you know, cold water basically on these chips and cycling them in real time. And so you're getting like very precise cooling at the chip level. And so like, that's really important because the quality of the chip basically degrades exponential with the temperature. So what that means is like, if the temperature is stable in a good, you know, cool threshold, the chip is stable for its life. Like in there, you know, that's how it works. As you kind of ratchet up temperature, the failure rates go exponential, meaning like you're going to fail more and more often just because there's more heat. And so with hydro, because it's like such a more efficient cooling mechanism, one, you get like more stable chipsets for longer, which means that like you can run these things for longer over time. You have the ability to overclock them without losing efficiency, which is important because if you can control the temperature, you don't lose as much efficiency as if you were overclocking an air-cooled unit. And the last thing is like they're way more power dense because you can, you know, control heat better. So like that means you get a lot more in a smaller, like call it like volume of space. And so you can be pulling a lot more power and it just is a much more kind of efficient layout. So like we love hydro and we see a lot of OEMs kind of shifting and like exploring more hydro cooled options. But yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like this is something that's existed forever, but we're seeing it like start to, you know, be really kind of the standard. I think air cooled will always exist because like you can't, you know, set up high. Like if you're just going to send the unit somewhere and run it in a chicken coop or something, like probably won't spin up hydro. But I think like a majority of my bet would be a majority of mining is going to be hydro, maybe not immediately, but like the production, like there's going to be more hydro. But that takes time to build out capacity. So it's kind of a, yeah.
So gun to your head, how long do these hydro machines last and what temperatures are you seeing?
Yeah. So I'll answer both questions. So on the temperature side, what we've been doing for the last probably like 4 months or so is we've actually been trying to benchmark, and I'll have more data that I can share. I mean, we can do another episode. We've been kind of trying to benchmark all OEM hydro setups. And so we currently have every, and OEM's like the manufacturer. So we currently have just about every one of the latest hydro cooled variants all running at, you know, the same kind of, we'll say the same geography, kind of trying to control for as much as possible. And we're just, one thing is we're just seeing stable temps across the board. I'll give you more detail kind of as the data comes out, like which chips are performing better or whatever. But like, it's really interesting to see. So we'll have some benchmarks around the manufacturers there. And then the other question was like, gun to my head, you know, how long do these things last? I would say, given the data we're seeing in terms of just stability of temperature, the physical life of these machines is going to be like 6+ years in terms of like they can actually run for that long, probably longer, but the economic life is totally dependent on, you know, the contract that you have in place. So that's a different thing. But I think like my, you know, gun to my head and like, you know, don't hold me to it. I think it's the wear and tear and the quality is basically like there's no wear and tear basically, assuming you're controlling for things like, you know, the pressure and all these things in the fluid. But I think these things will last a long time. You just have to find, you know, have the right place to put them and run them for the long term. So.
And what is the highest probability of failure? What do you think has the highest probability? Which part of failing in those 6 years or after those 6 years?
On hydro?
And what do you do if that happens?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it comes down to like basically the... So when you're moving this liquid through a loop continuously, you need to like make sure that the flow rate is sufficient to basically pull the heat out and do it well. So like if you have anything that happens with the pumping mechanism where you're not, the flow rate drops, like you're not moving the hot liquid out fast enough, you can see like chip level failures, right? Because the heat will pick up. So I think like controlling the pumping mechanisms and making sure the flow rate is good is like, that's kind of an operator thing, but like that's one way that these could fail. I think the other way is like it's somewhat similar and it kind of just affects the flow rate, but like each of these machines has a specific mix of, it's super interesting, there's a specific mix of glycol to water ratio that you'd need in the fluid that goes through, and it's slightly different per manufacturer. They might recommend a percentage of glycol to water that's different than another manufacturer. Now the other thing you have to control for is like the ambient temperature, because if you have more water to glycol ratio and at lower temperature, you might be more susceptible to like that stuff freezing or not flowing as well as quickly. So there's all these like almost like fluid mechanics and stuff to get right. But I guess like maybe your question was like what fails most likely. It's probably like something like that, like messing up the flow rate or the glycol mix. Obviously, power surges can always happen. Yeah.
What about the PSU?
Yeah. The PSU. Probably like I would say like of the thing that may fail quicker is probably the power supply. Those things are easily swapped out. Really what you want to make sure is that your chips are good. If your chips are good, like you're good.
Yeah, and that the operator is good, right? Because now you just said all of these machines have different kind of cooling requirements. So now when all of these machines are in one container, chained up in a loop, right?
Yep,
you need to have a partner that really knows what they're doing. And it sounds like you found exactly that, which is obviously very good news.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing that's interesting is the form factor of these. Like, we're seeing a trend to going towards a traditional like cabinet, like a U style form factor for these hydro-cooled machines. So you have like single U, two U, three U, they're all the same form factor horizontally, and then you can stack them on top of each other. But some infrastructure is not designed to take those yet, because a lot of the earliest hydro machines that came onto the market were like, we call them shoebox form factor. So they're like way different. So like we find a lot of interesting times where people will, hydro capacity? Yeah, you have hydro capacity. Great. I bought a bunch of these. Can I send them? And like, no one's thinking, will it actually fit? Because that's a whole different thing with air. It's kind of like, do we have enough, you know, CFM running through? Do the PDUs work and the cables work? And like, as long as we're clearing enough air, you're good. With hydro, it's just a little more complex, but the trade-off is like, you know, they're going to last longer. And
Tom, let's do a round of rapid fire for the short.
Cool.
You ready?
Let's go.
Cool. Short and sweet. One thing hydro hosting does better than any other cooling method. Kind of already answered it, but yeah, go again.
Dissipate heat, stable temps, and just high uptime.
Why not immersion?
Okay, immersion's interesting, because from like a physics perspective, actually immersion has a better, like, theoretical kind of, it can cool better theoretically, because you just have more surface area to pull heat from. In reality, it's a lot more, I think it's a more complicated system, because you have massive amounts of fluid that needs to be kind of changed out. You also have this idea of like, oh, I can take an air-cooled machine, strip the fans off, strip the grates off, and dunk it in fluid. That doesn't always work, because an air-cooled machine is designed for airflow, not, you know, liquid flow. So we've seen like a lot of failures there. I think there are immersion-specific types of machines that can go in immersion-specific containers, and that does great. But I do think in our experience, like, it just actually costs more to get right. Theoretically,
also,
it's there.
If I can ask,
practically, it's
practically it's not there. I just, let me add something there, because and now we're reading off the rapid fire, but it's fine, we'll get back there. My editor can do his magic. You run the risk of the oil becoming conductive. That cannot happen with hydro, right? So if you don't, if you have an operator that doesn't really know what they're doing, they're not keeping the air clean, and the basins are open or whatever, and oil gets sort of fed with particles, then that oil becomes conductive at some point. Anyway, let's crack on.
It's a lot cleaner. You need a lot cleaner of a setup, whereas like with hydro, it's a closed loop direct to chip. So you're only you have to control less volume, basically.
All right. Fixed price contracts or flexible pricing? Which works better long term? So let me rephrase this. If you had to choose today between fixed pricing or a profit split from the get-go, what would you choose?
In this market today, I think it depends on the efficiency of the hardware. But I would say like a profit split is a great option right now, because you're hedging your downside, and we're in a market where, you know, things are dropping. I think both are great. I'd say right now, probably profit split, but realistically, depending on the type of machine, it might still make sense to do fixed rate, albeit maybe at a lower uptime or something like that.
Worst contract clause you've ever seen in a hosting contract?
Oh my gosh, that's a good one. I think
ChatGPT wrote that one.
Yeah, that's a really, really good one. I think worst contract clause I've ever seen. I'll have to think about that one. I think one is like basically the unlimited ability for the operator to just like own the machines with very, you know, like low barrier to that kicking on. So like, as an example, hey, if you don't pay something in 7 days, like we own your machines now. Like there's very nuanced things where like you have risk of, like, you know, someone else taking title to your machine with, you know, unreasonable things. So I think that's, like, that's one. Yeah, there's probably a lot, though. So that's probably the worst.
If you had to choose, extend life via a profit split or sell the machine? And you're not allowed to say depends on the market.
For me, probably extend life through a profit split, because I'm just, I can mine for longer, and then I have the option to sell when the market is better for selling. So that's probably what I would say.
All right.
But it depends on the market.
Screw you. yeah, that's it, dude. We're done. Thank you, Tom. This was a pleasure once again. I'm glad we did this and I didn't go to bed. Guys, you already know where to find Tom. I did a previous episode with him not too long ago. Please feel free to check him out in the subscription and the subscription in the description. Leave a sub, though. Leave a comment and a like and all of that good stuff so that sponsors like Tom can see that people value this content. It's very important for them so that they can show them good data. Guys, thank you so much. Stay strong in this tough hash price environment. Let me just check. Where are we at the end of this recording? We are at 28 now. We used to be at 29.44. Remember those good times. And yeah, difficulty adjustment downward is coming, guys. Stay online. If you're interested in getting your feet wet, and getting into hosting now, I still think is a good time. And yeah, if you have any questions, let me know. Tom, anything else? Quick?
No, thanks for the time.
Cool. See you next time. Cheers. Bye.